Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. We will provide any significant news on the presidential election during the program. But as of right now, Joe Biden leads President Trump in Pennsylvania as votes are still being counted. With so much attention this week on the election, many have missed the news that the coronavirus is raging again. Pennsylvania set a one-day record of 2,900 confirmed COVID-19 cases in the 24-hour period that ended Thursday at midnight. We have had more than 220,000 cases overall. Most people who got sick have recovered, but more than 8,900 people have died since March. At the same time, there were almost 108,000 cases nationally, which also was a record high. Clearly, the fall surge has arrived. What's driving it, and what is being done to slow it down? Also, the Pennsylvania Department of Health has a plan to distribute a COVID-19 vaccine once one is available. Joining us now is WITS Transforming Health reporter Brett Shoulders. Brett, welcome to the program.
Hey, Scott. Nice to hear your voice and nice to be here this morning.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Brett, here's the big question. What's going on now? I mean, 8,900 cases yesterday, a one-day record. Pennsylvania, over the past 2 weeks, the cases have been going up. I meant 2,900. The cases have been going up over the past 2 weeks on a daily basis. What's going on?
Yeah, Scott. So 2,900 cases yesterday is an all-time high so far for any one day. And while there can be some little fluctuations in the daily rates that can be explained by things like more testing was done that day, what we know for sure is that the fall surge that was predicted is here. And it is worth saying, you know, we expected this to happen. This was predicted by health experts around the country. Let's just kind of think back a little bit. You know, cases went down in the summer, and you may remember when we had fewer than 800 new cases a day. The weather was warm. People started to understand the virus a little bit better. And then with the warm weather, for some people, they found more ways, relatively safe ways, to get together outside. And I should add outside, since there's, you know, there's not really a safe way to get together inside right now. There are safer ways, but, you know, outside, distanced apart, people were getting together. And I think that for some people, the overall fear level decreased. And now it's really a confluence of factors coming together as we go into the fall here, and as the weather gets colder and people do things like go back to school, you know.
Well, going back to school, I understand that that has had an impact on the increasing number of cases, that there have been students K through 12 going back to school. There have been college students who have returned to campus. Not all of them, not all of the K through 12, but that has had an impact on the numbers increasing.
Right. And, you know, I'm trying to find the right tone as we continue to report this. You know, we've been reporting on this since March. And what we're realizing is, you know, we are in for the long haul, Scott. We're in for a long ride of dealing with COVID-19. It's not going to go away within the next year. It's going to be with us. And so we need to find those ways to live our lives, but also do it in such a way that we're not driving the spread. And so I think with school, that was one of those examples where, you know, my heart really goes out to everyone with kids, because a lot of additional problems can crop up whenever you're trying to your kid go back to school and they're just staring at a screen all day. They're alone. They're at home. And I've heard from some of these parents, and so I really sympathize with their situation. You know, I will say, you know, I follow the county by county incidence rates. And that's the rate of cases per 100,000 people per county. Now, it's important to note that COVID-19 doesn't respect county boundaries, and there are limits to the value of that data, but, you know, there it also has value. Center County, the home of Penn State, of course, had few cases all summer, but became for a few weeks a hotbed of new case growth that was driven by students who were returning to school. And it had the highest incidence rates in the state. And so that's an example of how just one action, one school opening, or in some other counties, one outbreak at a long-term care facility, or one outbreak because of a gathering, can really drive case growth in a very explosive way. And so school was one of the big examples, but it certainly is far from the only example of what's driving case growth.
Yeah, this was anticipated, as you said, Brett, that when there would be children and students returning to school, that there would be more cases. I don't know whether we expected quite this many cases or not, but something you mentioned about fatigue. And I'm just thinking about over the past week. You know, I mentioned in the introduction that the news has been dominated this week by the election, which, you know, we don't have, any finality to right now. But it has been dominated by the news of the election this week. You have heard very little about COVID while records are being set. But I also get the sense that there is a real COVID fatigue, that I'm noticing that there are fewer people wearing masks in public. The majority of people are, but some places where, maybe in the summer or even back in March and April, where you would go to or, you know, pass by in public, you would see everyone wearing masks and being required to wear a mask. Now, here and there, you're seeing people not wearing masks. Do you think that fatigue is a real thing?
Well, Scott, I do think that it's real. I think I feel it. I think that my friends feel it. And you pointed out something really important, and I do want to talk more about that later, about different attitudes toward masks and safety measures among different groups and how that's sort of become politicized. And I think that is one part of it. But I will also say, I think that the pandemic fatigue combined with colder weather means that even for people who take safety measures very seriously, they're coming up with new ways to sort of convince themselves that they're being safe. And this isn't always the case, you know, and I just tossed a question the other day to the health department just to make sure I understood it correctly. And because one thing I hear a lot about is the idea that, maybe you can just get tested and then you can go out and interact in close quarters indoors with other people who have agreed to be tested. And I think this is something that it's something I've seen already happen, but it's also something I think that some people were banking on for the holidays. And we really need to prepare ourselves mentally for the fact that we may not be able to do this in a safe way this year. And I think that's really important because, you know, the Department of Health has actually advised against these traditional, you know, holiday meetups, everybody sitting around the dining room table for Thanksgiving inside, you know, sharing food. And I know that's really frustrating to hear. And so hopefully one thing that we're going to be doing at Transforming Health in the upcoming days here that we have planned is to be coming up with learning ways that people can adapt and continue living their lives, but also follow the safety protocols so that they don't get that older person at the dining room table sick, or so that they don't get themselves sick. Because it's not just you know, the oldest among us who are dying from this virus. And so, you know, back to my note on testing, it's actually, there are concerns about the, first of all, testing is good. It's free. You can self-test, and I'm happy to talk more about that. I've gotten tested at least 3 times, but it's an additional safety barrier. But because of the way that it can take a few days for the coronavirus to manifest, we've already seen instances where, and some of my colleagues around the country have done great reporting on someone who got tested and went to a family gathering and they still got other people sick. So I think it's really important that we don't let pandemic fatigue just, you know, kind of allow us to think that we can do some of those things. Does that make sense, Scott?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, something else to think about, we've all seen pictures of those large gatherings of college students with parties and that kind of thing. Not just college students, but large gatherings where people are out in public, shoulder to shoulder, many not wearing masks. But one thing that the Department of Health has been warning about, and you brought up the holidays, we'll talk a little bit more about that, but some of these smaller gatherings, like weddings or funerals, you know, where there may be just 15 to 20 people, all it takes is one person to spread that virus. So even if you're in a smaller setting with not a lot of people, there still is the potential for the virus to be passed on, right?
That's right. I think there was the perception that it was long-term care facilities like nursing homes that were driving these case numbers in some, especially in some of the rural counties. I think there was a perception that it was at places like prisons or at schools. In other words, places where a lot of people are living in close quarters. And for a while that was kind of the case, but it's not been the case for some time. And the Department of Health has come out, and for a while, especially when I was asking a lot of really granular questions on the county level, I would check in on some of these rural counties where I was seeing incidence rates that were the highest in the state. And that's something, you know, we can talk more about. It's the case even today. And, so I would think, you know, maybe this is all because there's one outbreak at a nursing home, but it's not been consistently the case. And the Department of Health will tell me that, no, we can't tell you what the gathering was or who it was because we're, you know, protecting people's information, but it was just one instance where people decided to throw a party, get together, and
I think we've lost Brett for just a moment. We'll get him back in momentarily here. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. If you're just tuning in, our guest is Brett Shouldes, WITF's Transforming Health reporter. We're talking about the coronavirus. Pennsylvania set a record yesterday. 2,900 cases reported in the 24-hour period that ended at Thursday at midnight. The country, the nation, also set a record, around 108,000 cases that have been reported. Clearly, the fall surge that we've heard so much about has returned. If you have a question or a comment about the coronavirus, COVID-19, the spread of the disease right now, Brett's not in a position to answer your clinical questions, but can talk about what he has heard from the Department of Health and the experts that he has spoken to around the state and around the country. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a phone call now from Harold in Harrisburg. Harold, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah. I have kind of a question, or I'm curious. If there's a way of checking that the people who have caught the virus, whenever they come in and they find this out, how many of them were at any of these big rallies or, for that matter, protests or where you could see people close with no masks on, such as at the airport when the president came, and that sort of thing.
Okay, Harold, thank you very much for your call. Brett, do you have any information on that? I know there has been some research about the rallies that President Trump held, but do you have any definitive information on that?
Well, yeah, there is some research that's been done on a national level there. And, you know, it's important to note that the virus doesn't care about your politics. It doesn't care about your cause. It doesn't have any, you know, bias toward one side or the other. Any gathering unmasked and close contact will drive the virus to spread. And one good example of that was the Sturgis motorcycle rally that happened that is considered to be was instrumental in driving a lot of spread in the southwestern part of the country. And the caller can do a little research and read about that online. I will say here in Pennsylvania, while we haven't been provided with a lot of specifics on, you know, who attended what rally or so on and so forth, just by looking at some of the counties with the highest incidence rates right now, some of those counties, you know, take Lebanon County, for example, which has had consistently higher case rates than the state average. That is a county that, as you may remember, Scott, you know, very publicly refused to follow the governor's mandates earlier in the pandemic. It's a county where the state representative in that county, Russ Diamond, has led a lot of the sort of efforts to gather people together and get them to oppose state guidance. And so I think that my point is that we can see correlation between attitudes toward masking and social gathering and increased case rates. And that's not just in Pennsylvania either. Some good research has been done that shows that places where the virus surges are highest are actually, this is a recent Associated Press analysis, it's in Trump voting counties, mostly rural areas, that have had the greatest recent virus surge. And the story also had interesting data about the attitudes and perceptions around the virus, showing that over a third of those voters described the pandemic as completely or mostly under control, with about half of them saying it was somewhat under control. And that's the stark contrast with Joe Biden voters, 82% of which said the pandemic is not at all under control. So this is in no way a dig on, I'm not trying to take any dig toward, you know, Republican voters. What I am saying is that the perceptions do appear to be different among the people who are in different parties, and that has driven surges in rural, mostly rural Trump voting counties around the country.
I wonder if the election, when it is finally over, when all the votes are counted, whether the results of the election, the elections being over, maybe not as much political news out there, so much posturing and campaigning, whether that will make a difference in the percentage of people who wear masks.
Well, that is really my hope, and that's the hope of some others as well. The idea that mask wearing has become political, it's not entirely without precedent, but it's pretty unusual, and it's something that a lot of parts of the world kind of look at us and just scratch their heads at. And you know, I think there is hope that that could be the case. And look, the place in the United States, the state that has the virus under control really well, that's not too far from us, is Vermont. And you know, Dr. Fauci called Vermont a model for how states should work to flatten the curve. And Vermont has a Republican governor. It's a good example of a state with a moderate Republican governor, a Democratic legislature, and they were able to avoid this sort of conflict conversation around the virus. I certainly can't speak to what's going to happen with our state house, but hopefully we'll see that happen.
You mentioned that there are those other countries that wonder about the United States and why we are not following some of the protocols. When I say we are not, that there is a segment of the population, a large segment of the population, not doing it. Great Britain, for example, there are some people who have fought back against wearing masks as well. But at the same time, as we're talking about the surge in the United States and Pennsylvania, there has been the same thing, an increase of a big surge in Great Britain, France, Italy, Spain. In fact, Europe is going into lockdown now. And I mean, that is their description, lockdown, of it, going back to some of the things that they did in the early spring when this first popped up in Europe. So we in the United States, if you look at lockdown as being something where you can't move around, at least in the United States, even though we have to be cautious, we still are not in that stage. But, you know, that's a long question, a long way to ask the question, Brett, that, there are other countries are seeing this as well, and they are taking more strict steps than what we are here in Pennsylvania and the United States.
Yeah, that's right, Scott. I mean, in the United States, we've had no concerted federal response, no consistent response. And basically, it's been left to the states. And so that's why we've had so much variety from state to state. And then here in Pennsylvania, the response has kind of, we started out with red, green, yellow. Dr. Levine, Health Secretary Dr. Rachel Levine, said, I think a day or two ago, that there's no plan to go back to that. So it does raise the question of, what's the plan here? As you're pointing out, even countries that are going back into lockdown and that have been a little bit more on the same page, they're struggling as well. I really would encourage people not to become fatalistic about this and try to let us just let the virus run rampant. That would be a real tragedy, I think, in this country, and in Pennsylvania, because while the virus is going to remain a problem, when we look at what some of the other countries are doing to take action, this isn't a mystery. The public health experts do have ways that we can work to slow the spread until we hit that point where we have vaccines, until we hit that point where we have more mitigation measures, and people will still get sick, but by slowing the spread, fewer people will die and more people will be able to get more treatment. And let's not forget the healthcare workers that we talked so much about earlier in the year, and that a lot of people I think are forgetting about now. They're the ones that have to be there to help out whenever you get sick.
Let's take a call from Barbara in Quarryville. Barbara, you're on the air.
Hi, Scott. You and I have spoken before, but I haven't had the privilege of saying hello to Brett. You do a good job.
Hi, Barbara.
I like what you're doing. And I just wanted to give a heads up. Some of us are doing the right thing. I'm in a relatively small 50-person personal care unit in Quarryville in a bigger facility. And we are very, very careful. We cannot mix people on floors. We have to stay apart. We're eating separately in the dining room. Right now we're eating in our rooms because we've got a couple tests that are positive in the community, not us. And we can't go out of our rooms. And none of us are resisting this. Nobody's cheating. We're doing what we're supposed to do, and our personal care workers are absolutely fantastic. And I just wanted to let you all know that there are some of us who are really trying to do it right, and we've had no cases. Well, so I think that's good.
Well, Barbara, I congratulate you and the facility where you're living, because it sounds as if they are taking this very seriously and doing it right. Thank you, Barbara, for being with us. Brett, I have to think that the majority of facilities across the state, like Barbara's, you know, obviously they were hit hard by this. I have to believe that the majority are doing the right thing and doing their best to try to keep their residents safe. It took a while for the state to provide testing, get that PPE to some of the workers in those facilities, but we've had fewer cases in those type facilities in the last few weeks.
Yeah, and I just want to say thank you to Barbara for calling and for listening. It was so good to hear her voice and just hear from her. You know, it's been a struggle for me to be able to talk to that. That's one person you often don't hear from in news stories, because people in personal care homes obviously are high risk, so we're trying to stay away from them, and they're, you know, it can just be a little bit harder to get those voices. And it's so important that we just hear her voice and realize that whenever people say something like, you know, these cases are mostly happening in personal care homes or nursing homes, it's like, well, even if that was the case, and it's not the case, there's community spread, but even if that was the case, shouldn't that be enough? You know, it's so important to humanize all those numbers. So I really am glad we got to hear from Barbara. And you're certainly right though, Scott, which is that things, the state response wasn't perfect when it came to the nursing homes, and it took a while to sort out sort of a coherent response to how to try to take those steps to mitigate exposure and protect people in nursing homes. The thing I think that's also important to remember is that there's no distinct break between a nursing home and the rest of the community. You know, those workers live in the community.
Let's take another call from Laura in Lewisburg. Laura, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Scott. Yes, I'm calling in from central Pennsylvania, from the Lewisburg area. And I just wanted to comment on a couple of things quickly. First of all, today's headlines in my local newspapers and radio stations online is that we have COVID the last 48 hours in several school districts locally, COVID cases for both staff, facility administrators, and students. So the second part of the headline was that football will continue. That's one comment. I think it's our job to protect young people from this pandemic. And secondly, I was in a grocery store locally in Mifflinburg yesterday shopping, and 40% of the staff on the floor, checkout people and stocking people, were unmasked. So I chose the route that we have available to us, which is to contact the Department of Ag. The Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture has a number you can call for food safety and handling. And so that was my second point in our region. And then finally, I want to make a personal comment. Unfortunately, retirement homes in our counties, in Union, Northumberland, I'm going to say Northumberland is this example, they are not masking. What is happening is times are so distinctively unsocial for these elders and people in isolation. And, of course, there's full lockdown in the retirement homes and personal care centers. But in this one in particular, they're holding functions, they're indoors, and they can't wait to get a drink in hand, because then they're allowed to take the mask off, and they do. So I think our education program is what's really needed here. But I want to circle back to the sports. I cannot believe how hard it must be for students to stay masked indoors. But when they come out and they're in close contact, it's our job to educate and to help them from a health and safety standpoint in Pennsylvania.
Laura, thank you very much for your call. Brett, she brings up several things. I want to start with the grocery store, though. When she said that she was in a grocery store where 40% of the workers were unmasked, that's shocking. That is not supposed to happen. That's against the law. I mean, what kind of business is doing that with 40% of their workers unmasked? They have to know. They have to know better than that.
Yeah, and that is not something I'll say that I have been seeing, but also I am pretty selective about where I go. It is a fact that the state has mandated masking in public spaces. That is against the state's order. Unfortunately, there hasn't seemed to have been much enforcement of these rules, though you certainly can, if nothing else, inform the health department when that when you see something like that. And you can also, inform the business itself. It's very disheartening to hear that that's going on. I will just say, I think that, back to the idea that this has become politicized, and hopefully that's something that we see kind of goes away after the election, the dust settles on the election. But the local leaders are driving these narratives. And so that's why you see such variety from place to place, in part, those local attitudes about the seriousness. When you see state representatives or state senators on Facebook or on video gathering with crowds of people indoors, that sends a message to people that this is not something to be concerned with, and that is just false. So I don't know what the solution is there, but at the least I would certainly get a different grocery store, and I know that's easier said than done for people living in some rural areas, but that's truly unacceptable.
Well, and she also brought up the football games. The decision was made to allow some parents and friends, and now more people, to attend some of these outdoor sporting events, well, even indoor as well. But those decisions were made in the late summer, early September, when cases were not increasing the way they are now. I wonder whether those decisions will be revisited. Have you heard anything to that effect?
I haven't heard anything explicitly about football or about outdoor sports in going into the fall. And you're absolutely right. I mean, when you look at the case rates, we're in a very different place than where we were in the summer. And while outdoor activity itself has a lower rate of spreading the virus than, close contact indoors, obviously the close nature of contact sports, and we need to look no further than some of our college and professional sports to see that how quickly an outbreak can happen in a locker room or with one team or as a result of one game. So I think it's something to look forward in the coming days and weeks to see how we adapt to this and what some additional steps are going to be taken. I think we need to let the dust settle on the election, and then maybe we can expect to see more of a concerted response from the state.
Well, we may not have time, but Karen, a listener, says too many folks are still wearing their mask half off their faces, nose is exposed. Just having a mask around your neck and covering your mouth isn't enough. Your nose is where the droplets are coming from for the most part. You have to wear the thing right.
That's the truth. I couldn't have said it any better myself.
Yeah. All right. One last thing here, Brett. I want to talk about yesterday. You attended a press conference or was in on a press conference with the Department of Health Secretary, Dr. Rachel Levine. She announced the state was preparing to get coronavirus vaccines. One of the things I found interesting here is that we don't have a vaccine yet, but the state is preparing for how it would be distributed once we do get a vaccine, if we do get a vaccine that is effective. So what did you learn?
Yeah, and I'm not sure how much time we have left to go into it, but I will say that it's important to note right up front that the state is, they're nearly ready to distribute and administer a COVID-19 vaccine. The first dosages are going to be for healthcare workers and possibly seniors living in nursing homes. And this is part of the federally approved plan that's going to use possibly multiple vaccine models from different companies to get emergency use approval from the federal government. But here's the really important point on this, and people need to understand that the vaccine, first of all, the state hasn't given us a timeline on when they'll actually get it. And the intel, what I learned from other sources is that I don't think it's going to be anytime really soon. And people need to understand that the vaccine is not going to be like a quick fix that lets them get back to, you know, January 2020 or December 2019 when they weren't thinking about this. The hope is that the vaccine is going to be somewhat similar to a flu vaccine in the sense that it'll prevent a good portion of vaccinated people from getting sick. And then it'll reduce the severity of illness in those who are vaccinated, but maybe still do contract COVID-19. So I think that's a really important distinction to make.
Well, you know, we've heard for a long time now speculation on when a vaccine would be available. But I think the point that you made right up front that even if we do have a vaccine, this doesn't mean that this will just go away, that it will be, you know, something that a percentage of people still will get the virus. Maybe not as many people, maybe not as many people getting sick. One thing I do want to ask you, Brett, and you're right, we only have a few minutes left. Who would get the vaccine first?
Yeah, and there are conversations to be had around that, but I think the understanding now is that those healthcare workers will be some of the first to get it. Obviously, they're exposed to so many people, and so it's an ethical and good thing to do to give it to them first, and also senior citizens, people living in long-term care facilities, nursing homes. Those would be among the first to get the vaccine. And then let's just note that nobody will be mandated to get a vaccine. That's something that the Department of Health has made really clear because, you know, unfortunately, if you, you know, for people who spend a lot of time scrolling social media, but not clicking into news stories, they get a lot of misinformation. And we know this, but, you know, there are a lot of false narratives out there that simply aren't true, and one of them would relate to the way vaccines will work. So, Scott, I'm just really encouraging people to find long-term ways to adapt, because the experts are saying we're not going to be seeing anything like a sort of quote normal for a year or longer. And even then, there are going to be permanent changes. So I think it's really important that we prepare ourselves mentally and focus on positive things that we can do. And I hope to, now that the election is kind of wrapping up, I hope to devote more time to this and connect with people in our community on some of the good, positive things that they're doing right now to adapt to life with this virus.
So, Brett, you probably have piqued the interest of a lot of people today. Where can they learn more about Transforming Health and what you're reporting on?
Yeah, absolutely. Transforminghealth.org is a great resource for a lot of what we do. Our stories, of course, are on WITF.org as well. And just really, really follow WITF and you know, follow us on Twitter and on Facebook. And we're going to keep you posted. Always feel welcome to, you know, reach out to us directly as well. We love to hear from people in the community. And sometimes, you know, it can be, you know, like hearing from someone like Barbara today was just absolutely wonderful. I really appreciate hearing what people's experiences are, because this is new for all of us.
WITF's Transforming Health reporter Brett Shultis. Brett, thank you very much.
Thanks, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News. And all things regional, I'm Scott Lamar.
For a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross.
Welcome back to Smart Talk. The presidential election, which is still not finalized, has dominated the news this week. It's not just an American story, because there's a great interest overseas. Ben Ponce is a Lancaster County native who is studying for a master's degree in politics at Manchester University in Great Britain. He also is a Dickinson College graduate, and he interned here at WITF. Ben Ponce, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, Scott, although I have to say, Gettysburg College, we don't like Dickinson.
Oh, I'm sorry. I knew I shouldn't have relied on my memory. Gettysburg College, kudos to the Bullets of Gettysburg
right.
College. I'm sorry about that, Brett.
No worries.
Ben, if you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. So, Ben, before we go on to, you wrote a column this week for LNP about what you've noticed and the attention that the election is getting in Great Britain. We were just talking to Brett Shouldis about what's going on overseas. And the UK is in lockdown right now due to the surge in coronavirus cases. What does lockdown actually look like?
Yeah, Scott. So the lockdown started just yesterday, actually. And it's a nationwide stay-at-home order to a large degree. There are exceptions, and schools and universities are remaining open. So that's one of them. But, you know, the lockdown was put into place after just 2 weeks ago. The government said that they didn't want to go down that route. And the situation has just spiraled so quickly over the last several weeks with just the reality of the virus, as Brett was discussing. And so, yeah, the lockdown looks, it feels somewhat like it did in March. It's a little looser, but I think to a large degree, it's kind of where, as you said, most of Europe has landed.
All right, so let's move on and talk about what you wrote about, and that is that you noticed, and it sounded just by the tone of your column, that you're a little bit surprised of how much attention the people in Manchester, the people that you've come into contact with, are paying attention to what's happening in the United States with the election. Talk about that.
Well, yeah, let me just pick up that thread right where we left it. Hospitals in the UK are reaching capacity, which, you know, that there's been a test and trace debacle here. There are six times as many daily positive cases today in the UK than there were at the peak of the pandemic, at least according to the testing data. And yet, 3 days later, every leading media outlet is leading with the US presidential election, and coronavirus and going into a national month-long lockdown has been relegated to the top of the hour news breaks. And frankly, that also is reflected in conversations that are occurring both within and independent of the university. You know, I mentioned in that column that I was with a group of people who had nothing to do with the university earlier this week. And the election was all that anyone was talking about in pretty gory detail. You know, it's not as if this is a surface level understanding of American politics that folks are displaying. It's the talk of Britain. And I think, you know, to a large degree, I just earlier today scanned some front pages of newspapers in Denmark and Germany and Japan and Singapore, and right on the top, 3 days later, mind you, Scott, is kind of just nuts and bolts coverage about the stakes of the U.S. election and what's happening. I think it has really, to a large degree, captivated attention in a lot of different places.
So what are they saying about the American election in the UK? The people you've come into contact, the media is a little bit different. I mean, you hear from a lot of different people around the country. But the people that you've come into contact with, what are they saying about the election and the United States?
There's a lot of confusion about why it's taking so long to get a result. And I think there's a lot of confusion in the States, mind you, on that point. You know, I've heard words like exciting from some folks who are a little detached. I've heard words like concerning. You know, I think the United States does, to a degree, still have something of a reputation as being a place that does democracy pretty okay. And this is calling that into question for some. And I think that more broadly, there is, in the media, it's and you know, you can see this reflected in conversations too. But phrases like "watershed moment for the world" are being uttered, and they're being nodded along to by people with whom I've come into touch, both students studying politics, which is not a representative sample for sure, but as I mentioned, of folks who are just kind of looking out and wondering what happens next, because you know the American presidency is a powerful office that touches an awful lot of people's lives around the world, both in terms of how the United States conducts its trade policies and foreign policy issues, and people around the world, including right here in Manchester, are paying a great deal of attention to that.
You wrote that it was kind of a wake-up call for you, in that you described earlier how this is the top of the top news story in Great Britain, but it was kind of a wake-up call for you of how much the world, England in particular, looks to the United States as being a world leader. Talk about that.
Yeah, I think it's easy to overstate this idea, but there is this reality that you hear the phrase "leader of the free world," and you know, from the States, that always seemed to me like a phrase that was a little contrived, that it was maybe a little self-aggrandizing in some ways, and whether people over here and elsewhere would agree that, you know, the president of the United States is the leader of the free world, there certainly is a lot of interest in understanding what leads the American people to choose him or maybe someday her, and I think that when things go awry, as and in particular, I will say candidly that the president claiming electoral votes, or saying that he has claimed electoral votes, and saying that we need to stop counting the votes, those are looked at as concerning signs for liberal, small L liberal democracy everywhere. You know, and it's not just in Britain. There's a cartoonist in Nairobi, in Kenya, who's been talking in public, social media and elsewhere, about this as how the U.S. would respond if this was occurring in Africa, and the line that he's used in public is that the U.S. is preaching water while drunk on wine when it comes to promoting these democratic values around the world, and sometimes not always realizing them at home as much as we would like to think that we do.
You mentioned a gathering that you attended earlier this week, and that was a prayer meeting, a Bible study group earlier this week. And there was something that happened there that is striking to me, and I could tell from your column that it really stuck with you as well. What happened?
Yeah, I mean, you finish, it's structured as, you know, I imagine in central Pennsylvania, some folks have been to a Bible study meetings, and you tend to do some studying. And then at the end, there was kind of pivoted into talking about praying as a group. And it kind of came up rather organically that people in this group were going to lead with the United States in wanting to pray for peace and calm and reconciliation, because I think that it's apparent how deep and polarizing division is. And it was just a really striking moment to see that around the world that's being noticed as well. It's not just that we feel divided at home, and I think that we do, but that translates and that has an impact elsewhere. And you know, I think intellectually you can kind of realize those things at times, but discrete examples like that matter.
Hmm. Ben Ponce, I want to thank you very much for being with us. It was just nice to talk to you, Ben, after all these months, not have an opportunity. Ben Ponce, he's a Lancaster County native studying for a master's degree in politics at Manchester University in Great Britain. Also, a Gettysburg College graduate and a former intern here at WITF. Ben, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Scott. Thanks for having me.
WITF's election coverage is supported by the law firm of Saul Ewing, Arnstein, and Lear.